KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor Alebrijes, the Milagro Theater annual Día de los Muertos theater production, running weekly on Thursday, Friday, Saturdays, and Sundays until November 11th at the Milagro Theater in Portland. Alebrijes is a family-friendly production of real-life artist and Alebrijes creator Pedro Linares, delves into his world and fictionalizes it to create this Día de los Muertos story. Full of mythical creatures, psychedelic jungles, song, dance, and larger-than-life puppetry. Again, that's Alebrijes, the Milagro Theater annual Día de los Muertos theater production, running weekly on Thursday, Friday, Saturday, and Sundays until November 11th at the Milagro Theater, 525 Southeast Stark Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
What does it mean to be called crazy in a crazy world? Listen to Madness Radio, Voices and Visions from Outside Mental Health, an affiliate of Mad in America Radio, broadcasting on KBOO in Oregon, sponsored by Portland Hearing Voices and the Icarus Project, and syndicated on the Pacifica Network. Madness Radio is online at kboo.fm/madnessradio and at madinamerica.com. Welcome to Madness Radio. This is your host, Will Hall. Today, my guest is George McCouch. George is a psychiatrist trained in Jungian analysis and process work. He's in private practice based in Central Oregon. George is the author of the recent book, While Psychiatry Slept, Reawakening the Imagination in Therapy. So welcome to Madness Radio, George McCouch.
Thanks, Will. Great to be with you.
Yeah, welcome to the show. I'm very excited about your new book, While Psychiatry Slept. There's a lot that I think the listeners are going to be really interested in, and especially in your work with what gets called psychosis, your understanding of shamanism, your understanding of the meaning in altered states and extreme states, and your real effort to try and get psychiatry as a whole to step back from the more mechanistic neuroscience brain-oriented reductionism that often happens. So it's great to have you on the show.
Thank you. I love the way you said that. I'm going to have to write that down. I love the brain-oriented mechanism. That's exactly right. It's way too much that way right now.
Yeah. So why do you think that it's too much? What would be the sort of the devil's advocate would say, hey, we have all this new science that's coming in, neuroscience, brain imaging, you know, the therapy and psychotherapy for psychosis or people with schizophrenia or a bipolar diagnosis, that's kind of in the past. That really now what we need is these new approaches. And what would you say to a devil's advocate approach question about that?
You know, let me stay semi-scientific for a second and say, you know, I was always trained in what's called the biopsychosocial model, that there may be something biological that you have to look at, something psychological and something sociological, system-based. And what's happened now is everything, there's such a push to the biology of it that when you see a lot of these writings and people say, well, this is the scientific or this is the evidence-based, what you find out is that they've become so blinded by those set of glasses they put on that they'll disclude other data that's so compelling that if you're truly being scientific, if you're truly willing to look at what's going on, then you have to include this other data, which often is the amazing psychological things that you have to work hard to not find the meaning in. For instance, I mean, right away in the book, I tell about working with a woman going through an extreme state, and you could make cases for the biology of it, of course. And she was in a hospital at that time, and we're sitting there in the office. She had trouble in her life where she had came from a very religious family. Her father was a minister, and he was very against her doing anything but giving her life over to God. And when she came in to see me that day, she had begun to have a relationship with a young man and said at that time to me, if she was pregnant, she was going to keep the baby. Now, this was a huge thing for her. And just as she said that, just as she said that, there was a blue jay that hit the window we were sitting by. And I had an office that was in the back of the hospital, way out in the field, no trees. I'd never seen a blue jay or any other bird there. And this blue jay hit the window, and then it hit the window over and over and over again. And I said to her, right at that second, I said, "What do you know about blue jays?" And she said, "They steal the eggs from the nest and kill the babies." And I said, "What was happening just as that happened?" And she said, "I had a thought that said I was evil if I had a baby." Well, that, you can't disclude that if you're truly being scientific. And when we began to then work together on how, we called it Blue Jay Man, would come and steal her and come in with those thoughts and try and steal her real feelings, there was a huge change in how she did.
So this is the data that you're saying that science, if to be truly scientific, needs to listen to. There's something with her very religious father being against her having a child with this this man she was having a relationship with.
Yes.
And that's, it makes me think of one of the things that caught me right away in your book was that the first thing you talk about is a dog named Boomer, and my mom's dog is named Boomer. So I thought, okay, well, that's a very interesting synchronicity there. I'm going to explore this. And and so I like that, George, that the idea is not to be rejecting of science or anti-science, but actually to kind of call out leading and mainstream and dominant science, because it's not scientific enough. It's not actually taking all of the evidence and all of the data, because it may be that if a blue jay hits the window and behaves in this very unusual way and it has real meaning for a patient, then wait a second, what's the so-called official normal scientific explanation for that? And we don't have one. But guess what? That's what nature is all about. There's a lot of mysteries in nature. And I think to actually be scientific, you have to be open to data that doesn't fit into established theories or schema, because it's there in nature. It's actually evidence. It's data that you can't ignore. And that, I think, is one of the biggest tragedies of the emphasis so much on neuroscience and the brain and the kind of chemical causality view, is that it makes a claim that science knows more than it actually does, and that actually life, especially human life, is filled with a lot more mystery and meaning than science wants to admit.
Yeah. And I think, you know, one of the things that I say early in the introduction, as I say, you know, I'm not trying in this book to just overthrow what's been done. And there, you know, certainly I've seen things by working as a psychiatrist that have been quite useful. But I, you know, one of the points I make is I say, you know, even though there may have been progress, that there's really, what I say in the book here is, however, in my opinion, all this process has had a dark side, or at least a parallel development heading in the wrong direction. As the age of the brain revolution has captivated psychiatry and its training and residencies, a corresponding loss of soul can be increasingly witnessed. Young doctors emerge from training steeped in the latest biochemistry and DSM diagnosis, but without exposure to dreams, the history of psychiatry and psychology, great literature, the body and its connection to the psyche, or any idea of alternative ways for viewing symptoms except through a prism of causality. That's one of my big complaints, is that it leaves out the art, it leaves out all the aspects of soul, and it's not trained in. And so as a psychiatrist now sits and sees somebody, they only look through that prism. They try and squeeze people into diagnostic categories even when they don't fit, because they have no other way of seeing it.
I think that is a very much true of the human crisis in general, that we've proceeded with this technological advance, but the dark side is a loss of soul, and it's affects mental health, it affects healthcare in general, it affects everything about how we live. And so I think what's beautiful about your book is that you really get into the detail of what would it be like to bring soul and story and meaning back into the center of what it is to be a healer in the mental health realm. One of the things that's striking about your book, and I think it makes a lot of sense to me, is that when I was doing my own clinical training, I was encouraged and, you know, basically required to write up these case examples. And it became very clear to me very early on that there was no way that I could do that in any kind of objective way, that they're really what these cases were are stories that I'm telling, and that it reflects as much my own creativity. And so I've always backed away from giving kind of, you know, case stories as if it was some kind of objective. And so that's what you do in the book. And I think you talk a lot about the people that you work with, but in a more general way, as stories and examples. And it points to the fact that if we go back to Freud and Jung, that actually the practice of psychiatry is very strongly rooted in literature, in philosophy, in the study of the world's religions, because this is what we need if we're going to actually address what it is to be human and what it is to suffer as a human. So tell us a little bit about story and why you chose to take a storytelling kind of approach in your book and in your work, and why is that important?
There's a great quote from Hillman in Religion, a book called Religion is Story, and he says that he has seen that children who have a connection to story and fantasy and reading stories, and their parents help them with story, seem to emotionally be much more grounded as they get older, that there's a sense that great literature and fiction is really the way the soul talks, the way this middle realm that is the realm of imagination and fiction and metaphor is really the way that we connect in the world. And it keeps it more fictional. The psyche is always trying to fictionalize things. It's a very, very interesting thing. A lot of people don't know that in PTSD, when patients come with the objectified, you know, horrific dream of the trauma, that over time, the way you'll see that they're getting better is that the dreams now become more and more fictionalized, more mythic. It seems as if that's what's trying to happen all the time, is that the stories are moving in that direction.
So break that down for us a little bit more. In trauma, you're saying that there's a fictionalization process, or there's a storytelling process that evolves in the psyche as part of healing. How does that happen? What exactly is that about?
It seems that the psyche itself is always moving towards fiction, that as it moves closer to imagination and fiction, that's also when healing is occurring, when people can step away and start to see, oh, you know, I'm caught in this figure or this, or the dream world seems to move it more into imagination and less into the literal aspect of this is what exactly happened, versus it moves it more into the imagination. And that was discovered originally by Harry Wilmer, a great Jungian analyst down at, he worked down in Texas, and he had a whole ward for Vietnam veterans with PTSD, and he discovered that, and then it's been written about more. And I've seen that not just in PTSD, but in what we'll call extreme states or psychosis. Things are very fictionalized, very imaginative in what comes up. And then people call that psychosis rather than seeing it as an altered reality that moves in that direction. For instance, I talk about some other psychiatrists in the book that have written in this kind of storytelling fashion, and I say that they've mastered a genre of fictional case histories by embedding their psychological wisdom and methods in their writing. In this style, simile and metaphor, image and sensual character are sought, and the cold abstractions of the scientistic are eschewed. The great Graham Greene, the great writer Graham Greene, thought that this allows for literal memories to come out not as journalism and purported fact, but by being thrown into the compost heap of time, they're altered into the deeper truth of imagination.
Yeah, I would say that definitely the arc of any healing trauma is really about the stories that we tell about the trauma and then our role in the trauma. And that's really what you're doing when you're sitting with someone and talking and bringing in different aspects that may have been excluded or blocked out or too overwhelming, that starts to come in. And the body plays a really important part in generating this. And there's always this sort of frozen quality at the beginning, or even an avoidance. And then when the storytelling happens, and what you're describing is this actually is a creative process. It's a fictioning process, but it's a fictioning that comes from the truth of some kind of soul experience that the person is having.
It seems to be natural to the psyche to do that and move it. And as it moves there, one gets more distance on and is be able to see the figures. You know, and if we stay with trauma for a second, you know, the horrificness of trauma and being the victim of it, it's a huge thing. I'm not downplaying that at all. But as a person starts to move in any kind of therapy, what starts to happen is that they are able to move into what are the more marginalized figures. They start to see that they're not the only being in their psychic house. And as that happens, that's when healing is also happening.
They may remember the story a little bit more fully, and oh, there was a figure or a person that was actually a positive element, or there was something that I did where I wasn't just a passive experiencer and victim of this trauma, but there's something that I did was actually had power or agency. And so the story starts to reflect an actual healing process. And so you're saying what I think actually a lot of neuroscientists are now saying, which is that storytelling and creating story, and the fact that the memory is a creative process and not some kind of like data entry, you know, photography of some kind, it's actually memory itself is creative. Neuroscientists are starting to say that we are storytelling animals, that that's at the very core of who we are. And you're pointing out how that storytelling quality is really at the core of healing and has to be part of any kind of therapy with people to help them with their emotional, psychological struggles.
Yeah. Storytelling Animal, that's one of my favorite books by Jonathan Gottschall.
And so therapy is really more art than anything. Medicine is really more art than anything. Would you agree?
100%. And I talk about Bernard Lown's book in the chapter that I wrote on the placebo effect, and an incredible book by probably the greatest cardiologists of the last 100 years.
Now, this is a really important book. Can you tell us the name of this book? Because when I discovered it, it just resonated so strongly about how to do medicine in a different way.
The Lost Art of Healing by Bernard Lown, LOWNMD.
And it's kind of considered a classic, although now it's a little bit kind of falling by the wayside.
Yeah, it really is a classic. When I was teaching psychiatric residents, at the end of each rotation, I would give them that book as a gift because it's so fallen away in the teaching. But it's an amazing book. And again, see, affecting and going into the imagination from a standpoint of the placebo and how words can heal. And that's an amazing, everyone should read that book.
One of the things that is the heart of his message is that healing is about listening, which I think is going to resonate with the Madness Radio listeners, because that's really the message of what we're trying to get across in Madness Radio, is that we have lost so much of our capacity to listen, to connect with each other. And so tell us about the bedside manner that you discuss in your book, and the placebo effect, and how this all weaves together with listening and storytelling.
Well, Lown does a great job in just saying that the listening is more, the art of listening is about hearing and seeing all that's going on. Story after story of Lown is about him noticing somebody's signal, looking the other way, or hearing a change in the voice drop, or
listening not just as a conveying information, but actually being present to all the different, the body, all the things that are happening, the nonverbal.
Exactly. If he and I were talking, I would be talking about that these are all the conduits, these are all the channels that the soul can enter from, or that basically the dream world is entering from. And he discovered that more as a cardiologist, and he's got story after story of when he followed those things, you know, wonderful things happening independent of what he was doing with medication.
So we think of cardiologists as like, oh, your heart is a pump and it breaks down. And so the cardiologist just takes a look at it and goes in there and fixes it. But actually, no, that's not. We're saying that in medicine in general, listening is actually central. And how does this relate to the placebo effect? And what are maybe some examples of the power of this, because you write in your book that words can heal. And I know this from my own experience, because when I was told you're schizophrenic, those words injured me. And then when I start to claim different words, I feel like the word and that identity and that story is a healing experience. So tell us more about the placebo effect and how that fits into this.
As you're moving in the process of life and your psyche's moving in this more fictionalized way, if you get off at a station called schizophrenia or a station called depression or a station called anxiety, that word literalizes and fixes right in time the way you start to see it.
Like it freezes you in an identity, and the identity itself becomes part of the problem.
Exactly. Exactly. And so this idea of fictionalizing things, you've got to get back on the train. And so when I see people and they come in, they tell me depression, I say, well, depression is a word that describes experiences, but it's abstract. Let's go into yours. Now you're into the individual. And that's what Lowne does in his book also. He's going into what's the... Yeah, you say you have this and this, but let's go into the individual thing about what you're feeling or thinking. One woman in there says, well, will the cardioversion that you're going to do to change my arrhythmia, will it help my back pain? And Lowne says, oh, of course it will. Now, there's no scientific evidence that it will, but why not do that? It's not going to hurt her. And the resident that was with him, right with the woman, the patient said, oh, that's absurd. He got in a fight with Lowne. And Lowne said, Lowne chewed him out later. But anyway, the woman's back pain got better. You know, why is that? Same thing. The most incredible story he tells in that book is when they went in to listen to a patient, a whole group of young doctors with him, and the patient had what's called an S3 Gallop. Now, that's a really bad sign in cardiology. That often means that the person, his heart is completely failing and they're going to die. But this young student said, oh my God, listen to that gallop. And a day or so later, the patient was checking out of the hospital, and Lowne only found out the story later that the guy said, when the patient, or when the resident, young resident said, oh, listen to that gallop, I thought, oh my gosh, my heart is really strong. It's galloping like a horse. What am I doing in the hospital here? And he lived like 2 years ongoing after that, before he finally passed.
So he was told something positive about what his heart condition was, and then actually got internalized and actually served a healing function for him. Now, this is something that's unique, you know, to humans and living beings. You don't send your car to the shop and like there's a kind of a sudden unexpected. But actually, if doctors are honest, they don't have control over the situation. There's all kinds of unexpected twists and turns, including unexpected healing. And in the mental health recovery world, we talk about being strengths-based. So you're not just focusing on the problem, but you're also recognizing that there's always strengths here, because those are words that now come into the person's story, that they do have strength, and then that actually has a strengthening and healing. And so give us an example of how that has played out in your own work.
Let's say an average, you're getting a placebo effect at least at 38% or 40% response rate with placebo. And in medicine studies, you only have to beat that by a couple percent, and you only have to have two studies that beat that to get it approved by the FDA.
So you're saying that for a drug to get licensed and to go onto the market, it just has to be better than placebo. But actually, placebo is actually really effective, and it just has to be a little bit more effective than placebo to say, oh, this is the drug that's helping you.
Exactly. So from just one standpoint, as a physician, you want to use all that placebo effect. You want to be not going, oh, the drug is a little better than placebo. You want to go, can I get all that effect from the placebo? So the stories that you tell, the way you watch the client, how many doctors are suddenly going to their computer and writing the script, or they're looking down and writing the script and they're not watching the patient. Let's say when I'm prescribing or have prescribed medications, the most important time, the absolute most important time for me to be watching is when I say, well, you know, with this, I've had some luck, let's say, with Zoloft, but now I've got to absolutely watch that person. Because right at that moment, let's say they sit back, take a breath, I see them look down and they say, okay, I'll try that. And then I watch that signal, like I said that Lown would do, and I call that out and I bring that out, and they go, well, you know, I didn't really want to use Zoloft, but I'm going to, you know, you're the doctor, but, you know, my sister had a suicide attempt when she tried it. And these things are way undertrained now. I mean, I've been teaching for 40 years, and there's nobody that comes in really understanding about placebo or what's also called nocebo, which is the negative effect with the mindset, like you just talked about with the Prozac. And all those things make a huge, huge difference. And there's no training in that. There's no training.
It used to be, because we're kind of talking about something broader than pills. We're talking about something like bedside manner, or yes, the presence, yes, of the, yes, healing, listening presence of the soul attendant, in a sense. I think that's what psychotherapy means. So, and there's no training of that anymore. It's actually dismissed. It's seen as noise. It's just statistical noise in our technological pursuit of these pills as machines.
I tell a story in the book of being at a major worldwide conference for child and adolescent psychiatry, and there's a major researcher said that they were having a 75% success rate with Seroquel for kids with bipolar disorder. But the problem was that they were having a 73% success rate with placebo.
That was the problem.
And that's what she said, but we got to figure out how to get the placebo effect to go down so that we can get the medication approved by the FDA.
Right.
And I remember running out of the room with my iPhone and dictating, like, oh my God, I got to remember this.
Yeah. Yeah. Because we forget that it's not just a pill. It's the attention. It's the listening. It's the expectation. It's the ceremonial ritual of going in to a doctor. It's the encounter with this powerful person with all this science behind them. It's the entire array of everything that the person has ever read on the internet or in the media. A pill is actually a meaningful event. It carries stories. It carries all kinds of symbols. And it's not just a technological or chemical factor in someone's brain chemistry.
You know, R.D. Lang, the amazing psychiatrist from Scotland who did Kingsley Hall and worked that way, you know, he has an incredible chapter in his book's Politics of Experience called The 10-Day Voyage. And he asked the person what they needed. And they said, I needed a sheet anchor. I needed a connection that someone knew or understood or could be connected with me. I'm in an age range back of studies of LSD. In fact, I went and did some workshops with Stan Grof back in the early 80s at Esalen. And it was clear that set and setting made a huge difference. If you were with a sitter in an LSD experience that was very positive, you would have a positive experience from it. And if you weren't, you wouldn't. And Jung says very clearly, just in what you were just saying, that the biggest problem in psychosis is that if the person is met with the sense that they're still understood, that they're still connected, that there's a sense of meaning, that there's a sense of being connected with and understood, then oftentimes they can come through it. But when they lose that and in the middle of it and they don't feel that connection, then they go into a panic, and the panic itself is the thing that then drives it.
George, we're just about out of time. Remind people the name of your book and also how they can get in touch with you.
My book is While Psychiatry Slept, Reawakening the Imagination in Therapy, and you can get it at your local booksellers or online. I'm working in private practice in Sisters, Oregon, and I have a website called Central Oregon Psychiatry, and you can connect to me through my website.
George McCouch, thank you so much for joining us today on Madness Radio.
Thank you. It was a real pleasure, Will.
You've been listening to an interview with George McCouch. George is a psychiatrist trained in Jungian analysis and process work. He is in private practice in Central Oregon. George is also the author of the recent book, While Psychiatry Slept, Reawakening the Imagination in Therapy. That's all the time we have on Madness Radio. Thanks for tuning in. You've been listening to Madness Radio, Voices and Visions from Outside Mental Health. Madness Radio host is Will Hall. Producer is Nina Packabush. Madness Radio is an affiliate of Madden America Radio, broadcasting on KBOO in Oregon, sponsored by Portland Hearing Voices and the Icarus Project, and syndicated on the Pacifica Network. Madness Radio is online at kboo.fm/madnessradio and at maddenamerica.com.
And you are listening to KBOO Portland. The time is just about 12 o'clock. It's time for the KBOO News at Noon for Monday, November 5th, 2018. In national news, midterm elections are tomorrow, and new reports suggest that in addition to mass voter suppression in a number of states, voting machines that are subject to glitches could impact the election results. The hacker-prone and outdated voting machines are being used throughout the nation, from Texas to Georgia to Wisconsin, and they are raising alarming questions about the integrity of vote counts less than 24 hours before millions cast their ballots in the critical midterm elections. In Texas, civil rights groups are saying this machine problem is threatening to call into question the entire election in Texas. That's the state where Democratic Representative Beto O'Rourke is vying for Republican Senator Ted Cruz's seat in an extremely close race that has drawn national attention. Civil rights groups have alleged that voting machines are deleting Democratic votes entirely or switching them to the Republican candidate. The voting machine problems are in addition to barriers to voting erected by right-wing politicians looking to suppress minority turnout in key states. In other national news, a lawsuit that originated here in Eugene, Oregon, will be allowed to proceed. A group of youth suing the government for failing to take action on climate change have won their chance to have the case brought to trial. The Supreme Court ruled against the Trump administration's attempt to have the